I was going to say good evening, but it depends where you are in the world. Good morning for some, or good afternoon. I hope I've made it worth your while, all over the world to listen to this. Basically, I just want to give a fairly short introduction, make a few points about George Orwell, and let the get sort of stir up some discussion. I see in the Standard it's advertised as that I'm going to look at his writings and political ideas, but I think to talk about someone's work, you need to his life, George Orwell or Eric Blair's life, and what happened to him made a great influence, of course, on what he wrote and what he said and what he did later in his life. Helps explain what he said, what he wrote. And I suppose that's the same of everyone, really. I mean, there's a lot of his writing relates to personal experiences. Some of it's clearly autobiographical, and others are more sort of abstract or theoretical. So, I mean, we can start. I'll start by saying that his influence is still with us now in the words that are words and phrases that are in popular use in the English-speaking countries, at least, especially in the UK, and the fact that we have TV shows called Big Brother and Room 101 have been on in this country, and a sort of somewhat distorted idea of what he meant. I mean, I think Room 101 is quite an entertaining show. Room 101 was something awful. It's the worst possible thing you could imagine, thing you feared the most, and it's the torture chamber in 1984. Big Brother, well, it's a show, and when I first saw it, I think it started in 2000, where they hold up these people in a building to see how they get on, and we're watching them. I thought, this will never be a second series of this, surely. It's just so, I don't know, puerile. But it became very popular. And I think that says something about the sort of society, modern society, and how quite the sort of thing that Orwell predicted, things he could already see in the 1940s. Yeah, so, you know, we commonly think of, use expression like doublethink and the thought police and so on. I'm not sure if Orwell actually invented these, but he certainly made them popular through his writings. And he usually attributed to them, and also talking about Orwellian to mean a dystopia. It's sometimes even applied to buildings. I've heard it talk about Orwellian architecture, and I think they mean some sort of monolith, something like built in the Soviet Union during Stalin's time. Thinking of an image of what the Ministry of Truth would be like. Anyway, yeah, I'll just briefly say something about his run through his early life. So he was born in India in 1903, and the following year he and his mother and sisters came to England. That was quite a normal thing to happen when in the sort of families that were working in the civil service in India or elsewhere in the British Empire. So Eric Blair's father was a civil servant supervising opium production. He came from, the family was sort of lower middle class, using the accepted, the sort of expressions for class stratification that Orwell commonly used, you know, this idea of this middle class with its various streams, levels, you know. And some of the middle class weren't very well off, which included him, really. So he goes home, sees very little of his father. And he's obviously a bright boy. He went to a primary school, St. Cyprian's, which he describes later on in Such Were the Joys, it comes across as a terrible place. Someone else who was at school with him sort of didn't see it like that at all. So that's what happens. We all have different experiences and different memories, good or bad, about places. So, yes, he was bright. He earned a scholarship to Eton. I think there was no money around for him to go to university. Otherwise, he probably would have done. So he went out to Burma and joined the police force, went to Burma. I think in Burma he had an aunt, so there was some connection with the place. And he served in the police in Burma from the age of 19 to 25. And was also very good at his job. He was put in charge of security at an oil refinery, which is quite an important part of the Burmese economy. Incidentally, Burma oil, I think it's now part of Total, French multinational. But, I don't know what I'm saying exactly, but Burma, the chairman of Burma Oil was one Margaret Thatcher's husband, whose first name I've now forgotten. Dennis Thatcher. Anyway, yes. So he was a good policeman, apparently, but while in Burma, he gained a reputation as an outsider. He just did not fit in with the colonial culture. And his experiences there he draws heavily on his own experiences for a novel called Burmese Days. There's also a number of, I think there's some other little stories, one about killing an elephant. So at the age of 25, he comes back to Britain and decides to quit from the police force. And he's sort of feeling confident about making a living as a writer, or at least he doesn't want to be in the police anymore. So he then goes to this period of tramping. He explores mixes with the poor in London, sees the inside of a lot of doss houses and finds out how these people live. And he also goes to Paris and gets a job. He works in hotels and sees in the kitchen, especially, and sees some terrible things. And these get worked up into the book Down and Out in Paris and London, published in 1933, where the publisher, who was Victor Gallant, was quite worried about libel. And it does seem that Gallant was not the ideal publisher for Orwell. By the way, he thought of the name. I think it was Gallants wanted him to think up a pseudonym. And I think because his father then retired, moved to Suffolk in Southwold, I think he arrived at George Orwell because Orwell is a river in Suffolk and the king's called George. And this is how he dreamt up this pen name, George Orwell. So there we are. So that's about 1933, George Orwell, the writer, arrives. And he's clearly a workaholic. And there's a vast output of essays, book reviews, articles for newspapers. He also did his broadcasts. He did a year of broadcasts in World War II. He just couldn't hack it anymore. That's 1942 to 3 years at the BBC broadcasting to India. And I think he was sort of had his doubts as to how many people are actually listening to this stuff. I've drawn quite a lot of this from a biography of Orwell by Michael Sheldon, which was published in 1991. I did read it some time ago and I dipped into it and was just rereading it. Also read an earlier biography, which was by Bernard Crick, which is concentrates more on the politics and on the works. I don't seem to have a copy of that anymore. But Sheldon's one, there's more about the life and personal details. It's from, he certainly was writing sort of, it's notorious for not getting much sleep and working away. And probably worked himself to death. He obviously had a problem. Eventually he had diagnosed with TB, but he was suffering from ill health for certainly most of his adult life. But from 1933 to 1949, there's one big work, there's one book coming out each year. So you've got Down and Out in Paris and London, Burmese Days, Clergyman's Daughter, Keep the Aspidistra Flying, The Road to Wigan Pier, Homage to Catalonia, Coming Up for Air, Inside the Whale, The Lion and the Unicorn, Animal Farm. It's a lot of critical essays about Dickens, Darley, and others. The English People, which I haven't read that. 1984. I haven't read, there's quite a lot of things I haven't read. I'm sure other comrades, people listening in will probably have. The Lion and the Unicorn, certainly not familiar with that. I mean, the most popular books, the books with the which were most successful were Animal Farm in 1984. So, it's a savage irony that after he died, he made the most money, I think. because they're really not very small print runs, very small sales of the earlier books. He was only known in a fairly small circle. He's only really becomes a popular writer with Animal Farm, which is, you know, great success all over the world. And he knew it was before he died in 1950, and he was seeing the profits from it, and he's supposed to have actually complained about all the tax that he's having to pay, even though he'd been very much in favour of taxing the rich and, you know, wanted the new Labour government in 1945 to tax profits, etc. So we see it seems that he was not really very political to begin with. It's early. He was very much an observer, a commentator. And he really starts to become political around about 1937. And his politics change. I think it's fair to say there's a late developer in politics. You know, during his teens and 20s, he just was finding out stuff, really, and improving his writing technique. He always wanted to write clearly, simply, be able to communicate. It's very much, there's a lot of stuff he wrote about flowery, fancy language and trying to avoid it, avoiding double negatives and, you know, speaking plainly, reporting what you saw. So, yeah, it's after going to Spain, the Spanish Civil War, you start to see some real political thoughts developing. So he wanted to go to Spain, fight on the Republican side of the Civil War. He found a contact, found someone he knew was a member of the ILP, the Independent Labour Party, and their sort of sister organisation was called the POUM, P-O-U-M, Movement of the Revolutionary Left, probably more radical, more left-wing than the ILP, actually. But that was his contact. He goes to Barcelona in the autumn of 1936 and fights, he notices how badly the POUM militia are prepared. I mean, they've hardly got what you could call uniforms. They've got very old rifles. He realizes that, you know, the training they're getting is rubbish, where they're just lots of marching around. They're not in any way prepared for modern warfare. So off he goes to the Aragon front, and he's good at the humour. You get these bizarre things that happen. And he says the fact that, you know, in a civil war, so the other side speak the same language. And he said there were, the Republican side would try to make the Franco, the nationalist side, desert. So they'd be shouting at them through a loud hailer, saying, "Come over here, comrades. We're just about to have buttered toast," this sort of thing. I just remember that. It's just a clear and absurd scene. Of course, they hadn't got any butter, but that's the way you think. It's very static, actually, this first part of the war, because of basically they were too far away from the enemy, so they were almost out of range. It wasn't like the trenches in Western Front in First World War. After this stint, he returns to Barcelona, and this is where things really kick off, because he's been trying to grasp the politics of what's going on in Spain. I mean, he naively talks about let's not get mixed up in all this politics. Let's just concentrate on the war. We want to fight Franco. He doesn't. To begin with, he doesn't appreciate all the various dimensions of what's going on. And these are still with us today, really, in Catalonia. The autonomy, regional politics was a factor in the Civil War, and also in the Basque Country. It's not that they didn't want king, they wanted a republic. We also wanted a level of self-government, which wasn't the case in Spain at that time. It's very centralised. So anyway, fighting breaks out in Barcelona between basically the anarchists and the Trotskyists. Like the Poon are Trotskyists, and the Communist Party, the more right-wing factions, those who are pro-Soviet Union. I think at that time, the anarchists had control of the post office, probably the radio station as well. So this was more violent. This is far more serious and dangerous fighting going on in Barcelona than he'd seen out where they were supposed to be fighting the nationalists. And so after that, he actually goes to, I can't remember quite where, but somewhere, another part of the fighting, another part of the front in Catalonia, and is shot and seriously wounded. And shortly after, as he sort of recovered from that, he leaves Spain in the spring of 37. Now at that time, and his wife were sort of wanted people. He was very lucky not to end up in prison, because he was on the hit list of the Republican government and their Soviet allies. And there were lots of spies. I think someone they knew quite well was actually an agent of the Soviet Union. And so I think his experiences in Spain start to develop some more political thinking. And from this time on, I think, I can't remember quite when he said this, but towards the end of his life, he said that everything he'd written since a certain date, which is probably like over a 10-year period or so, was to oppose totalitarianism and promote democratic socialism. So, but his ideas of socialism are quite different to ours, and I'm sure a lot of comrades will talk about this or point this out later. Anyway, having come back to Britain, he does actually join the ILP. His experiences of war, he changes his mind, because I think somewhere in Homes Catalonia he says, war is evil, but it is the lesser evil. Then he seems to change his mind, becomes a pacifist, until Second World War breaks out. And then in 1939, he becomes quite, he wants to play his part in fighting Hitler and Nazis. And this is, he's unfit for active service. Gets this job at the BBC. He described the BBC as being sort of half girls' school, half lunatic asylum. And I think there's some more experiences in there with the bureaucracy, the form filling, the way the BBC was run, sort of that finds its way into Animal Farm and 1984. Yeah, so I think it's a sad, it's a bit of a tragedy that I would say that these books, Animal Farm and 1984, generally in the sort of 50s and 60s, certainly, they helped the right wing during the Cold War period. They were, you know, loads of school children would have read them, lots of people have read them, and they see it as anti-communist rather than just more straightforwardly anti-dictatorship. You know, this Animal Farm, there it is, it's about a revolution, it's betrayed. And then what Airstrip won, this country, in 1984, it's sort of seen to be the Soviet Union. But I think Orwell intended it to be much more general and much more about where they were, you know, about when it was written in 1948 or 1949, that know, this, we're living with all this propaganda. It's hard to know what the truth is, and people talk and write nonsense, but they make it sound, they make it, they're so enthusiastic about it that you're taken in. Yes, so I just wanted to say a little bit about Orwell's political views, really. I mean, he's, his idea of socialism was certainly not common ownership, wasn't a moneyless society. I think he is more sort of in tune with what the Attlee government were doing. He's more about sort of just trying to make capitalism a bit fairer and kinder. He had a bit of a romantic view of the working class, I think. And the British had this idea that the British were fundamentally decent people, who are all for sportsmanship and fair play. And that was as far as it goes. It might seem a little unkind, but he wasn't, he never towed any party line, and he was not terribly deep thinker on these things. I don't know if he read much really of Marx and Engels, etc. But I think I will stop there. I think that's not too rambling. There's so much you could say about him, and I hope we get some good contributions from the rest of you. Okay, thanks.